Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing founder, you know, a founder that has done it, you know, multiple times. You know, he's on this rocket ship that I'm sure many of you have heard. And we're going to be talking about all the good stuff that we like to hear. Building, scaling, financing. We're going to be talking about getting fired as a founder from your own company. Dynamics, you know, with board, with co-founders. Also coming from Europe and being here executing as a foreigner, you know, also perception and culture. I mean, it's a little bit different. I'm a European too. So we're going to have the battle of accents, which is another one. We're going to be talking about running out of money, you know, another big one, you know, that every founder at some point experiences. And again, a lot of good stuff. So brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Mario Schlosser. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Alejandro, great to be on. If you don't have a European accent, you got to practice to have one, I think. But I do think German accents beats Spanish accents. So I
got you there. Good stuff. Almost. So let's talk about that European thing, the European roots on your end, Mario. You were born not far away from Frankfurt in a small town there. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Come from a relatively small town, 18,000 people, called Hochheim am Main. They call themselves the gates to the Rheingau. Rheingau is a Riesling area. So I made some money picking grapes when I grew up. And it is an idyllic German town, like plenty of German towns. I'm always amazed when I fly back from the US to Germany, how parceled up and manicured everything in Germany is. It really is a lot of people in a fairly small place. Its own little medieval city wall around it, and relatively very, very far, I would say, from the ambitions of Silicon Valley or the ambitions of New York. I mean, I live in the Upper West Side of New York now. I've been here for 20 years, something like that. I was in the Valley for quite some time as well. And the kind of horizon extension you experience when you go to American institutions like Harvard Business School or whatever, and they tell you you're going to be the leaders of the free world is so different than when you grow up in Germany. And one funny thing, actually, when Germans apply for Harvard Business School and you hire or you a tutor or you ask people how you do that, they will tell you have to exaggerate your resume because Germans will always understate what they've done and Americans will always overstate what they've done. And so that to me is just an incredible illustration of the differences between the cultures there.
And what about engineering? You know, what caught your eye about engineering?
My father's a middle school teacher, and he studied sports and religion, actually. And he also taught German and geography, whatever, all that stuff. And my mother is a NICU nurse. So is my sister, actually. So there's not a lot of engineering in the family. My grandfather was a quasi-engineer, so to speak. He didn't have a title, you know, fought in World War and just worked at a German industrial firm afterwards, but was a fantastic sort of craftsman, if you will. But I got a Sinclair ZX81 computer with 1 kilobyte of RAM when I was 8 years old from a friend of my father's and a bunch of like manuals that all had, you know, lots of coffee stains in them with a bunch of basic listings. I mean, literally listings in the programming language basic, and started typing those in. And that got me hooked on coding. There was not a great environment of knowing other people. And so I tend to this day to be a fairly solitary coder. I always notice this. Again, a big difference perhaps between Europeans and American founders, if you will. The American founders will always immediately think about how can I make other people do the work for me? And maybe the Europeans sort of think I got to do it myself. But it trained me fairly early on to just playfully figure out how to get something interesting out of the computer. And did not really have any formal training there at all. And in fact, later on, when I went to university, then struggled with whether I should even go study computer science or engineering, and didn't do that initially. I won a bunch of prizes in a German competition called Jugendforscht. Young people do research. I built an eye tracker in 1995, 96, putting a camera on the computer. It would film your face and figure out where you're looking and whatever. And so you would think that would then put me on the path towards, oh, I should study engineering. And even that I thought, no, this eye tracking thing I liked because it was creative and not just technology. Like it was interesting, it was colorful. It had something to do with sort of human computer interaction or whatever. And I thought that's sort of my sweet spot, the combination of these different fields, not so much just writing algorithms, if you will, or designing chips, whatever else. But anyhow, that's where the lust for computers got awakened with that ZX81.
Now, in your case, I mean, you studied, you know, I mean, obviously you were into this. I mean, you were getting into eye tracking devices, computer linguistics, I mean, all types of like technical stuff. But it was a professor that ultimately gave you the chance that changed everything, which was to do an internship in Silicon Valley. So how did as a European, I'm sure that you were like, my God, what's going on in here? Now with all the innovation around you. So how was that experience for you?
Yeah, I initially went to the University of Trier in Germany, southwest of Germany, roughly, because they had a computer linguistics course. So a mix of linguistics and computer science. And so I'm so glad I didn't stay there, because computer linguistics got completely reinvented in the early 2000s and went from rules-based to then entirely statistics-based, and away from the sort of Chomsky grammar space to then just essentially early versions of deep learning and so on. And now, of course, it's all deep learning, linguistics. And I had met a professor who was a chip design professor, electronic design automation professor in the University of Hannover. And he told me, come up and just go study hardcore engineering, computer science, actually electric engineering, computer science, a combination of the two. And I just went and went there and did some chip design, whatever. I had my bachelor thesis was designing a algorithm that would read signals from the heart after cardiac surgery and would map them into a risk of atrial fibrillation, and to design a chip for that, or an FPGA to be precise, building sort of like an early version of chip design programming language and then flushing that through that. And that professor then got me an internship in Silicon Valley, as you said, with a company called Infineon, German semiconductor company, still exists to this day. And it was a magical time for me, because I landed in, I think, SFO or San Jose Airport, I don't remember exactly. And just remember driving down the 280, one of the highways, there's 101 and the 280 in Silicon Valley, into San Jose at the time. So I must have come from SFO, obviously, then. And saw a sign for Stanford over the hills, and Mountain View on the signs, and all these magical Silicon Valley names I had never seen from close up. And I loved that so much that I wanted to stay. And then when the internship was over, thought, okay, what do I do next? And I called up a bunch of professors at Stanford who I thought were in fields that I knew something about, computer vision, network switching design, chip design, and so on. And then a German professor who was at the time in the database group at Stanford in the computer science departments invited me to come over and become a visiting scholar there. And that was a fantastic time then as well. I wrote a whole bunch of publications, I think 10 papers or so in just about 2 years, one of which became a quite influential paper that then 15 years later or so won at the World Wide Web Conference, the so-called Test of Time Awards, which gets given to papers that's sort of endured the test of time. And so the first paper that got that award was the Larry Page and Sergey Brin Google paper. And then I think two or three papers later, it was this paper that me and my buddy had written. So anyhow, that was then, that wouldn't ever have happened, I think, if I hadn't gotten somehow myself, my professor hadn't gotten me over there, and if I hadn't gotten myself then to stay in Silicon Valley and find those connections.
But rather than going farther into the startup world, you know, you go into McKinsey, right? Which is totally unexpected. I guess from that time of McKinsey, where you were for a couple of years, what was your biggest takeaway about problem solving?
It's a strange thing. I think, like many entrepreneurs, if I try to be a bit self-reflective, I have some combination of just incredible self-delusion of sort of playing my way through life, if you will. In the best situations, I feel just incredibly excited and curious about doing something new and with complete reckless abandon for how successful I might be at it. And I think, honestly, perhaps not having gone to Harvard undergrad or whatever and having been in the sort of like hamster wheel that now my kids are in. I have a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old in the Upper West Side in Manhattan. My wife's Brazilian, I'm German, so none of us ever really experienced growing up in a high-powered U.S. city. But those guys, they've already gotten more rejections by the time that they turn 10 years old than my kids. Then I almost had a life, because you got to go and apply for schools and for kindergartens and all that kind of stuff, and interview and do testing and everything else. And I didn't have any of that. And so for me, it was really all upside, if you will. And the McKinsey thing, McKinsey Germany at the time had a recruiting program to go to American top universities and find the Germans there and try to convince them to come back to McKinsey Germany. For me, it was another one of those playful things. So I thought like, oh yeah, shit, I'd love to see what these guys do. They stay in 5-star hotels. I'd never been in a 5-star hotel. I'd never flown business class or any of those things. let me do that for 3 months. I think it was actually 2 months internship in late 2021. And so, actually late 2022. So combination of that playfulness and then also not really having particularly high confidence that any of these things will lead to anything. Sort of thinking, well, what do I have to lose? I'm probably not going to be very good at it. I probably don't know how to do it, but whatever, might as well try and might as well see how far I get. And I think the fact that I was able to talk myself into Stanford Computer Science gave me some confidence that if you force a randomness in life, it can go in your favor every now and then, you know? And so I went there, and in what is very typical for me, I made no plans whatsoever beyond the 2 months. I didn't get an apartment. I didn't rent anything. I just literally had a sleeping bag and I bought a suit. In McKinsey, Germany at the time, you had to wear a three-piece suit. So a suit and then a tie and then a vest as well. I don't even really sell it anymore, that stuff. But I was at that time still very conservative. And I just bought those things and just crashed in hotel rooms all the time. And that was it. And I moved back in with my parents for a while and slept in their basements. And I'm like, oh, whatever. I can just travel around and go to Amsterdam on the weekend and fly to Rio de Janeiro with my friends at McKinsey for the weekends and come back again. And that was an incredibly interesting life to have for a while. Because at the same time, I realized, you asked me a question about problem solving, that McKinsey had very, very different problem solving muscles than what I had learned in computer science and at Stanford and so on. I mean, Stanford was an incredibly high IQ place for sure, still certainly is. I did not necessarily think that my German university in Hannover was that much less than that. So I think even my German, you know, physics classes, whatever, all had some had incredibly smart German engineers in them. The difference is the people at Stanford go and start companies. The guys in Hannover would go and work for a German Mittelstand company, you know, like one of those companies in Braunschweig, whatever, or in Karlsruhe, that are incredibly good at what they do, but they build some weird computerized ball bearing, whatever, and they sell it to, you know, three other companies in the world. And some people there would never think that they could start that company themselves. So anyhow, McKinsey had an incredible sort of like look at the world from the top down and decompose a problem into its constituent parts and look at it that way. And I remember calling my Stanford professor after I'd been there for a month and saying, and the thing I was impressed by was how quickly McKinsey consultants built Excel spreadsheets. And I then actually remember also a year later, McKinsey sent me to a mini MBA. They used to do that for people who didn't have a finance background. They would then give you sort of like an MBA in 2 weeks, whatever, 3 weeks. And so that was the first time in my life that I met hedge fund people and investment bankers. I'd never met investment bankers before. And I was incredibly impressed with those guys because they knew how to not only do Excel, but they use Excel with keyboard only. I had to use the mouse, whatever. They had all the keyboard sort of tricks, right? Insert a new line or whatever and build a model very quickly. And I just remember to this day how that seared into my brain how impressive I found that. Today I find this incredibly lame to build spreadsheets in Excel. But the fact that I found this so mind-blowing was such an illustration of how foreign that was to me at the time and a very different way of problem-solving and very impressive. And McKinsey, the sort of chutzpah of going into the CEO's office and saying, I'm 21 years old, but I will now tell you how to run your business is a kind of good thing to learn at some point as well.
It's really spectacular. And I think that probably gave you some perspective on maybe it was time to switch gears and to go to the business side. And perhaps that came, you know, with going into Harvard Business School. And that was a pivotal moment for you too, because you were able to meet who ended up becoming your co-founder on a couple of startups, right? And that was Josh Kushner. And for those that don't know who he is, he founded to Thrive, and they just did an amazing, they led the round of, if I don't remember wrong, of ChatGPT and OpenAI. And that was like yep. 150 billion valuation, 6 billion, you know, round, unbelievable. So what an yep. amazing guy too, no? So you guys meeting in Harvard and that changed everything.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I went to business school really. So I remember when I said, okay, I should just go there. I felt almost bad because to me, going to business school was a sign that I really hadn't found anything interesting in life to focus on. I thought that the people who go all in on risky bets and just go and fucking start their own company, whatever, those are the ones who are going to make it big. And here I was going to business school and playing it safe and everything. But then I said to myself, I have 2 years to start companies. And I just started that summer of 2005. This is when I went to HBS programming again. This was the early days of Facebook and MySpace and whatever. In fact, I have an email from Sean Parker from, I think, January 2005 saying, hey, Mario, We started a company called the Facebook Common. Do you want to come in and have a chat and talk about what we're doing here and love to get you on boards? And I looked at the site and I saw it was written in PHP. I thought only script kiddies write websites in PHP. And so I said, no, I don't have, you know, I'm not interested, don't have time. Actually, I think I was in Brazil at the time for a McKinsey project. And like, I like too much down here. But even at McKinsey, by the way, I took a summer off in 2004 and went back to the Valley and started with a friend of mine who then later on became a professor at MIT, a startup that was about online, purchasing online assets effectively. So you could make a ringtone, sell it to your friends or whatever. Too early for its time. Friend of mine at the time was doing a mobile photo sharing company. This is like 6 years before Instagram, whatever else. And of course it flopped. These were like the grainy, small Nokia photos, whatever, early cameras in phones. Shows how much timing risk there is to any kind of startup. But the reason I mention this is because I just always flittered back and forth so much between thinking, oh, I should try to go and I want to be in a big company, or no, I want to do my own company. And I almost looked at it as a bit of an A-B test, which one I like better. And I had various points in time where I concluded for myself, I will never do a startup again. And then it always happened again, and finally for the better. But certainly for founders, I think this means the vast majority of what I did on the founding something side went absolutely nowhere, either because, you know, friends of mine stopped, like the people I was doing it with didn't want to do it anymore, or because I lost interest, or because, you know, we raised some money and didn't use it properly, whatever. That will just happen to you. I feel like the people who are lucky and for whom lightning strikes very early on are probably in the minority there. And so, but then lightning struck with me in the form of meeting great people at HBS and Harvard Business School. And yes, as you said, Josh was one of them. He was in the college at the time, actually. And through a friend of mine who was in my HBS class who knew him, we got together and we said, let's start a social network for Latin America. A friend of ours was from Honduras, actually. And so he added the whole Latin America angle. And I had been programming a social network because I had missed that Facebook thing, you know. And then we did that for a couple of years, but also not full time. After HBS, went to Silicon Valley again, raised a little bit of money for this thing, slept on floors, slept in a garage also in Silicon Valley. And then financial crisis starts. And I said, okay, let me take the one job that I interviewed for at HBS, which was with a very smart hedge fund called Bridgewater Associates. And they were very much ahead of their time at the time and understanding what's happening in financial crisis, deleveraging and debt crisis and whatever. And so that was super cool to be there for. And as is my wants, I had no plans, no rents, no, owned very few clothes, and just literally slept on an airbed for the first 6 months and rode to Bridgewater through the ice and storm of the winter of 2007 on a shitty old bicycle or whatever. And I bought a rental car for $500 or whatever that then at some point just died. Yeah. And because I thought I'm going to stay there for 3 months and leave again. And then I ended up staying 3 years.
Wow.
So just always getting sucked into something. Yeah.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
But at the same time, you know, you were doing Vostu, and, you know, Vostu, basically, you guys were able to grow that nicely in the U.S. I mean, you guys were calling it the Singa of Brazil. Now, for those people that don't remember Singa, no? The video game that was attached to Facebook too, and that's how kind of like they blew up. But in your guys' case, you became the Singa of Brazil until Singa came knocking with a lawsuit, which kind of like changed course. What happened there?
Yeah, Vostu was an incredible story. I mean, it was really a reminder of how viral growth can work. Actually, one funny story that I will tell very briefly, because I also think it goes to how, as a founder, you have to pay attention not just what you want your company to be, but what the signals are you get from the outside world. So when Facebook opened their platform in 2007, that was the first, in the summer of 2007, was the first time you could put apps onto Facebook, which then led to Zynga in the next 2 years or so, right? Zynga blew up in 2008, 2009 or so, when games started running on the platform. So right on that first day, in 2007, I was in Silicon Valley. That was when I had graduated from Harvard Business School, and we spent that summer there, as I just mentioned. And there were all these ex-Facebook people, which is also, by the way, a great story. Almost the entire first generation of Facebook people all quit 2 or 3 years after the founding. And so they're not really that known to history anymore for their being at Facebook, but they're known for other reasons, perhaps, right? Start a company afterwards. But the valley was full of people who thought Zuckerberg was a complete child, man-child, and a terrible CEO and impossible to work for, and be a shitty company, go out of business or whatever. I mean, it was full of these people who had worked at Facebook, and they just left. Many of them actually sold their stock then in secondaries in 2008, 2009, and for like $3 million, whatever, which is a lot of money, but it could have been $3 billion if they had held onto it, you know, not too many years later. But it just so goes to show that even Facebook, plenty early of the early years, would have gotten totally wrong if you had looked at the company in that moment in time. So Facebook opens the API in 2007. We were trying to build this Latin American Facebook. And I said, you know what, screw it. Let me put an app on Facebook. I'll just do it. And I asked a friend of mine to design 10 icons. And we said, let's do a gifting app. These were popular at that time. And we did an app called Sexy Gifts with 3 X's, because the one with 2 X's was already taken, or the 1 X was taken already. And you had like a whip and a dildo, literally, and like a blow-up doll or whatever, like you'd send to your friends, like little icons. And you would level up the more gifts you sent, and you would have like weird levels. You know, that would be an incredibly crude app, frankly. But I put that thing online, and it had like, and I had a BlackBerry at the time, and so a little website where I could watch the stats on this thing. And then first day, like three users, me and my two buddies in the startup, which we had not raised money for at the time. Next day, like 4 or whatever users, and next day then 5 users, and the day after, 100,000 users. And then the week later, my server operator called me. At the time, there was no clouds, right? This was all like Java, whatever machines that some Java server ran on in somebody's basement, basically. That guy calls me and says, you're completely blowing up all of my traffic. What are you doing? You gotta pay me more. And I paid like $100 a month for this thing. I said, oh, you know what? This is not worth it. I don't want to be known for being the guy with a sexy gifts app, you know? And so I just shut it down. And it was such incredible, in hindsight, idiocy. Because here we were getting an incredibly early glimpse of the insanity of viral channels, programmatic channels opening on a social network. And we just said, no, let's build our own social network. It's the dumbest thing. And so Mark Pincus, who was not as smart as we were and didn't know how to code, he's like, oh, let me just put a poker on Facebook and see what it does. And that's what became Zynga. Pincus was the CEO of Zynga, who then sued us, whom we to this day still hates. Now he's spouting bullshit on Twitter again. So I think I can still say this. And yeah, when we then eventually became super popular for our games in Brazil, which we then finally put on the Facebook of Brazil, which at the time was Orkut, who happened to actually be a friend of mine from my Stanford days, who had gone to Google and built a social network called Orkut, literally named after himself at Google. We were the biggest game provider on Orkut in Brazil and had something like 30 million Brazilians playing our games every month, which was a third of all Brazilians on the internet at the time, or even more. And then when that really started taking off, and we called ourselves Zynga Brazil, eventually Zynga sued us for copyright infringements. And that thing got settled fairly quickly in an adventurous lawsuit that is almost too long to tell the story about, you know, corrupt judges in Brazil, and then, you know, crazy fights between, you know, US court and Brazil court, whatever, all that kind of stuff. But in that settlement time, all of us founders, we were 5 founders or so in that thing, started fighting with each other about all kinds of stuff. I didn't talk to Josh for a while. my other buddy, Daniel Caffey, who was the CEO actually of the business. I was only the chief scientist, which was sort of game design and analytics, whatever. We fought a bunch, then we all made up again, but then the rest of the company was tired of us. And so the board stepped in and fired all the founders. Mm. And that was really the beginning of Oscar, actually. That was in March 2012. And I came back to New York. My wife was pregnant. Josh and I had a coffee and licked our wounds and said, what the hell do we do now? And Josh said, I'm going to start a venture fund and I would like to start an insurance company. And I said, okay, let me try to help you with the insurance company parts. And then,
wow. So then, for the people that are listening to hear it, what ended up being the business model of Oscar Health? How do you guys make money?
It's really a health insurance company at its core. So very simple business model and very well-known business model. You take in a monthly premium and 80% of that premium will go out the door for healthcare costs. And then 20% go into administration and sales and marketing and things like that. So that's how every insurance company, a health insurer really operates. But the particular flavor and idea behind Oscar was that, and there is a bit of a through line for me there. At Bridgewater in the Global Macro Funds, it was all about modeling the global economy and understanding how money flows throughout the global economy. I really think what attracted me to the gaming world was we were building our own economies. I mean, I'm not joking. This is really, I had all these big spreadsheets, there they are again, that simulated all these economies. You have to, as a game designer, you have to really figure out, okay, do you give you 10 coins for this or 20 coins, whatever. How does this all work? How do you balance all this stuff? And that stuff I liked the most, honestly. And so when I thought about health insurance and healthcare, when Josh mentioned this to me, the biggest thing that appealed to me was, number one, the insurance company is the designer of the economy of the healthcare system, because it sets the reimbursement rates for physicians and it sets what it costs the member to navigate the healthcare system. That's what the insurance company determines. And the second thing is it can incentivize members to do things differently. You know, it can make certain drugs cheaper, certain physicians cheaper, and all that kind of stuff. And so you had sort of control over this economy to some degree with these incentives. And that was the motivating factor for Oscar. And what we didn't even know in early 2012, what became clear in the summer of 2012, was that the so-called Obamacare reform or the so-called Affordable Care Act was about to launch on January 1st, 2014. And that, for the first time, created an individualized health insurance market in the US. So don't want to take this too far, but very briefly, if you live in the US, you will have insurance either from your employer or you won't have it at all. That was the case before Obamacare. And so 40 million Americans had no health insurance whatsoever, which is hard to imagine for certainly anybody in the rich Western world or even not rich rest of the world, that the rich country in the world has all these people uninsured and going bankrupt when they get cancer or whatever. Obamacare created the market where as an individual you could buy health insurance. And we thought that means Oscar can, for the first time, be consumer brands and can develop a real relationship between you and the end user. And that became Oscar Health.
And for Oscar, how much capital have you guys raised to date?
That's a great question. I can't even tell you exactly. So we raised probably about, I'd say, 600, 700 million before our IPO. We went public in March 2021. And before that, 600, 700 million or so, thereabouts. The biggest round we had was in 2018 when Alphabet, the Google mothership, really from the corporate balance sheet invested in Oscar. And a guy named Salar Kamangar, who was employee number 9 at Google, he was the one who bought YouTube for Google and ran it for a long time before Susan Wojcicki took over. He was the one who ran AdWords for Google very early on and pioneered that. And he was so excited about Oscar that he wanted to join our board and got Google and Alphabet to invest. That was in 2018. That was a $375 million round, which today almost sounds small, but at the time was like by far the biggest venture rounds, I think, in that year, even for any company, certainly in healthcare in the US. And then in 2021, we went public. And in the IPO, we raised $1.5 billion. So in total, I think capital in is probably about, you know, 2.2, something like that. And so, yeah, then went public. I ran the company for the 2 years after the IPO. The stock price went into the toilets for really that entire time, virtually, for all kinds of reasons. I mean, really sort of the public markets getting fed up with money losing companies. You know, we avoided the SPAC route. Fortunately, we did a real IPO, but that was when all the crap came online or public through the SPAC routes. And so the biggest thing though was profitability. And we then really, really, really painstakingly moved the company towards profitability. And when we were very, very close to it 1 year ago, in April 2020, I had met a guy named Mark Bertolini, who used to run one of the biggest US insurance companies called Aetna, who was retired basically. I'd met him in the IPO process. I talked to him, ended up talking to him once a week as a mentor-mentee kind of thing. We tried to get him to come on the board. He didn't want to come on the board. And I'm like, all right, let me talk to you at least once a week. And so I talked to him for 2 years really in a row. And I would always joke, come to Oscar one day. One day you'll work at Oscar. And then he eventually said, like, yeah, maybe I should. And then as a founder, to me, it's very clear you cannot share power for an accountability, ultimate accountability for running a company. It just does not work. Never do co-CEOs. Co-founders are fantastic, but you have to have different roles. It doesn't work any other way. And so when Mark said I would want to come in, I knew it would be extremely silly for me to try to say I'll be the CEO or executive chairman or whatever, and he does something else in the company under me. That was stupid. And it was also going to be stupid for us to somehow be co-CEOs or whatever. And so I said, I'll become CTO, running engineering, data science, product, security, and so on. And then he's the CEO. He's my manager. And that's worked, I think, phenomenally well. And it's really helped the stock price as well. The public market saw right away Oscar is serious about staying on this path of profitability and growing the business. I think hopefully public markets also thought Mario's still there that provides technology leadership and stuff like that. And it came at a good time because language models blew up and whatever. And so I could do more in that space as well. So it's been
in the last year, the stock has increased by like 94%. So, you know, I think that the market is definitely appreciating that. I guess question here, if you...
940%.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Factor of 10.
There we go. Yeah. There we go. Not bad. Not bad. Not bad. Not bad. Yeah. I was missing a zero there. So thank you for pointing that out. Now, let's say you were to go to sleep tonight, Mario, and you wake up in a world where the vision of Oscar is fully realized. What does that world look like?
I think that the real trade that should be happening in the US healthcare system is for there to be an entity that counsels you very early on in a very, very personalized way as to what you could do differently for your own life, given who you are, given how you live, given where you live and all these kind of things, to just keep yourself healthy and happier throughout life, and gives you incentives and very concrete action items to go and follow that. And if you follow that, you're statistically very, very likely to be a happy and healthier person. And that entity can really only be the health insurance company, because the health insurer is the only one that makes more money if you are healthier. If you go to the emergency room less, if you take fewer drugs and all that, or if you take the right drugs and all those kind of things. And it is also very clear that great studies that show that if you're 40 years old and you go work out twice a week, whatever, and you then look at the costs you incur once you turn 65 years old and beyond that, in all kinds of, and you deconfound all that stuff, you will be cheaper for society because you'll be healthier and you need less taken care of and all that stuff. And so we could take all those future savings and give some of those to you today. And it means we could pay you to work out. We could pay you to go even healthier. We could do all kinds of stuff to just make you happier and feel better and so on. It's not a matter of money, because the money is there. The future savings are there. And that requires a very, very engaging and trustworthy brands in healthcare and consumer brands. It requires a lot of machine learning and modeling and so on as to who you are and what's good for you and so on. And it requires someone who can control the financial incentives in the healthcare system. And all these three things are in some shape or form true for the health insurer. Most health insurers have no idea how to do any of these three. But we built Oscar from the beginning to say that's the infrastructure we want to have to be able to go and do that. And so, you know, I would think of Oscar as the doctor in your pockets eventually, that will just constantly say, hey, Mario, you know what? You should really go take the weekend off, whatever. And I will give you $100 to go have a beer, because I know that that will make you much happier and healthier and more productive even. And I can afford it as the insurance company to pay you that, because I know it's going to be good for me and you, really. So that's what it's got to go to. And so, look, maybe we'll all be digital lives anyway in 5 years when we solve AGI or whatever. And maybe that becomes a very different way of insuring, you know, than people. But for as long as we are in this mortal plane and have these physical bodies around us, I think that needs to get built at some point.
Absolutely. Now, we're talking about the future. I want to talk about the past real quick here. And if I could put you into a time machine and I bring you back to 2006, that moment where you were thinking about starting something, right? With let's say, with Josh. And you're able to have a chat with your younger self and give that younger self one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I mean, I think the biggest thing really is it's very clear that people who go through various crises and somehow navigate them, that requires a degree of luck, certainly in every crisis, at some point get used to managing crises. And it's always astounding to me how much humans can rally to. And I don't mean in any way, by the way, to compare being in the trenches of Silicon Valley to being like in the trenches of Ukraine or whatever. You know, like it's not the same at all, obviously. But, you know, trying to fire your best friends from your startup, whatever, or trying to get money when you almost run out of it, which happened many times to Oscar. I mean, we really were very quite close to worrying we got to try to pull some eject cord here, whatever else, at various points in time, going back to us all the way as early as December 2015, when we came very close to it. You know, the Affordable Care Act almost got shut down when Trump got elected and all these things. When you navigate these things somehow, you then eventually get used to it. And that is a good thing to tell your younger self. Even me today, we had an Oscar alumni event this week. And it was like 65 people or so from Oscar. And I think among those 60 people, there were something like 40 startups of these folks leaving Oscar and then starting their own companies, which I find amazing. I mean, that's really, there's no better sign of a company's culture if people leave the company and then start companies by themselves. Way better than going to work for an insurance company of another kind or whatever. And we collected all these photos for that. And so I saw myself on these photos, you know, 5 years back, 10 years back, whatever, different hair color, still less gray and whatever. And I just remembered, I almost can't imagine anymore from today's point of view, even how to get through some of those difficult moments that some of these photos were taken in, you know, like again, bad open enrollment periods, bad growth, bad cost blowout and whatever. But we did get through it. And so just chilling out about that, I think, is a good one. This playful attitude I mentioned before, somehow you have to maintain. And that's also the reason, clearly, why people, I know, do their best work for Nobel Prizes. And again, I don't mean to start companies that are winning Nobel Prizes. You know, it's not the same. But why didn't their best work when they at a young age? Because your own bar for failure goes up so much. And I think the best entrepreneurs just have a complete disregard for that. Whatever you think of Musk, and I certainly think he's a complete crazy person recently in what he says and what he does. That is the thing that's amazing about that guy, that he just is like, all right, I'm going to put all the chips back on the table all the time. You know, if you can live that way, and live with the consequences, right? That doesn't always go well. In some sense, that's an interesting way to do it. And you don't need to blow yourself up all the time and end in the streets, whatever else. But I really do think that we're given so much growing up in the Western rich worlds, having, you know, good educations, at least, you know, you and I, that we almost owe it to people around us to say, yeah, let me take a bit more risk than maybe others can. Let me take others with me then as well, right? Like then you can try to create jobs and mentor people in the company and the startup you have and things like that. But don't forget that like just, all right, let me go through it playfully and not worry about how I feel. Like it's my job to feel bad about this and get through it.
I love it. I love it. So Mario, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Very simple, mario@highoscar.com. My email.
Amazing. Easy enough. Well, hey, Mario, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thanks, Alejandro. Super fun.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.